This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Mastermind. Drugs, Empire, Murder, Betrayal. This is the author, Evan Ratliff. For Bill Goggins, 1963 to 2006. It takes very little to govern good people. Very little. And bad people can't be governed at all. Or if they could, I never heard of it. Cormac McCarthy, No Country for Old Men. Author's note. This book is a work of nonfiction. It is based on more than 4 years of reporting, including hundreds of interviews, hundreds of thousands of pages of law enforcement reports, government databases, court documents, and internal communications from a criminal organization that involved thousands of people and conducted business on 6 continents. I have worked to corroborate every fact found here and to speak with as many participants as possible. Unfortunately, I couldn't speak to them all. Some are dead, murdered because of what they knew. Others declined to talk to me, out of fear that they might meet the same fate. Still others are in prison and desperate to avoid the perception that they've turned on their compatriots. A few are in hiding, running from prosecution or vengeance, real or imagined. But dozens of the people involved did share their stories with me, at risk of physical danger, legal jeopardy, or professional consequences. In 3 cases, specified in the source notes, I've altered the subjects' names. I did so because they feared for their safety and that of their families, because they were never prosecuted for the crimes described here, and because their names didn't appear in legal proceedings connected to these events. In other instances, I have described certain minor players, including some law enforcement officials or family members, only by their job descriptions or connections to more principal figures. Every individual in this book is real. The events they describe happened. Prologue. 2012, The Puzzle. Monrovia, Liberia, September 26, 2012. On a gray afternoon, 3 men enter a drab hotel room for a business meeting, months in the making. 2 are white, a portly South African and his muscled European deputy. The other, with dark hair and a paunch of his own, is Latino, Colombian, or so he says. The hotel is in the Liberian capital, abutting the Atlantic Ocean on the coast of West Africa, but it could be any number of places in the world. The men's business is drugs and weapons, and drugs and weapons are everywhere. They shake hands, nod heads, and begin speaking in the elliptical but familiar way of people who share the vernacular of a trade. They're cautious, but not cautious enough. A video exists to prove it. I can see why you picked this place, says the South African, settling his substantial bulk into a maroon leather couch pressed against the wall. Because it's chaotic. It should be easy to move in and out from what I've seen. His name is Paul, and to a trained ear, his cadence carries a twinge of not just South Africa, but his childhood home, Zimbabwe, where he lived until his teens. His large white head is shaved close, and what hair remains has gone gray as he approaches 40. He has the look of a beach vacationer cleaned up for a dinner out, in an oversized blue polo shirt and a pair of khaki cargo shorts. His clothes seem out of keeping with both the scope of his international influence and the deal he's about to complete, with a man he believes to be the head of a South American drug cartel. Very easy, replies the Colombian, whom Paul refers to only as Pepe. In the video recording of the meeting, Pepe sits down just off screen on a matching couch. His disembodied voice speaks in flawless, if heavily accented, English. Very few people, not too many eyes. It looks like the right place. Trust me. What's your name again? Paul. Paul, trust me. It's the right place. I've been here already for quite a bit of time. And always, me and my organization, we pick places like this. First of all, for corruption. You can buy anything you want here. Anything. You just tell me what you need. Yeah, it's safe here, Paul says. If there's a problem here, you can fix it. I understand this type of place. Everything is easy here, just hand to hand, boom, 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 you can see, Pepe says, laughing. Well, thanks to your guy here, now we're meeting. He gestures at the 3rd man in the room, the European employee of Paul's who goes by the name Jack. It was Jack who made the initial connection between Paul and Pepe. The deal Jack brokered was complex enough that, when I meet him years later, I need him to walk me through it several times. The Colombians, who deal primarily in the cocaine produced in their own country, are looking to expand into methamphetamine, which they want to manufacture in Liberia and distribute to the United States and Europe. Paul, a computer programmer who heads his own kind of cartel based in the Philippines, will provide the materials to build the Colombians' meth labs, precursor chemicals, formulas for cooking them into meth, and a clean room in which to synthesize it all. While the labs are being built, Paul has also agreed to sell Pepe his own stash of meth, in exchange for an equivalent amount of cocaine at market rates. After months of back and forth, Jack has urged Paul to travel to Liberia to meet his new associate, Boss to Boss, to finalize the deal. "So where do you want to start?" Pepe says. "First of all is the clean room." Paul tells him that the parts needed to build it are already en route by boat. "If you have any problem, I'll send the guys here to assemble it like that." He snaps his fingers. "We shouldn't have any," Pepe says. "I got my guys here, my chemist." Paul responds, "To compensate you for the delays, we will just, when we do business, we will give you back the money." "Paul, you don't have to compensate me for nothing." Paul flicks his hand in the air. "We feel bad it took so long." "This is just business," Pepe says. "We don't have to compensate, just doing business. This is about money." Pepe turns to the second part of the deal, the trade of his Colombian cocaine for Paul's methamphetamine, a sample of which Paul has shipped to him from his base in the Philippines. "Let me ask you a question," Pepe says.
"Sure.
You're not Filipino. Why the Philippines?" "Same reason you're in Liberia. Basically, as far as Asia goes, it's the best shithole we can find, which gives us the ability to ship anywhere. It's the best position in Asia, and it's also a poor place. Not as bad as here, but we can still solve problems." "You are cooking your shit in the Philippines?" Pepe says. "Actually, right now we manufacture in the Philippines and we also buy from the Chinese. We're getting it from North Korea, so the quality you saw was very high." "That's not just very high. That is awesome," Pepe says.
"Yeah.
I was going to tell you that later on, but now that you talk about it, that stuff is fucking incredible." "That is manufactured by the North Koreans," Paul says. "We get it from the Chinese, who get it from the North Koreans. So my product is going to be the same, the amount that I'm going to buy from you?"
"The same, exactly the same," Paul nods.
"I know you want the high quality for your market."
"Yeah, because the product, you know that one of the best customers, and you probably know that, is the Americans."
"Number one."
"It's the number one. They're fucking, they want everything over there. I don't know what the word is from Spanish. Consumistas? Consumists?"
"Consumers," Jack interjects, off camera.
"Yeah, they buy everything and they never stop," Paul says.
"So everything that I ship is to America," Pepe says.
"Trust me, when I brought this, fucking everyone was asking me for it. Everyone."
Paul and Pepe consider different payment possibilities. First, they will trade the cocaine for meth. After that, Paul says that he is happy to be paid in gold or diamonds. If they need to conduct bank transfers, he works primarily through China and Hong Kong, although he sounds a note of caution. "We just had, in Hong Kong, $20 million frozen by bullshit," he says. "You need to be cautious. It becomes worse because the American, he likes to control everything. And they are there, making a lot of trouble."
"I say fuck Americans," Pepe says. "Americans, like you say, they think they can control everything, but they cannot. It's not impossible, but they cannot. We have to be very careful."
They discuss shipment methods and how many kilos of each drug the other could move in a month. Paul owns ships already picking up loads in South America and traveling to Asia, but he much prefers to work in Africa, territory he knows well. His customers are in Australia, Thailand, China. "We're not touching the U.S. right now," he says.
"Why not?"
"Actually, we move pills in the U.S., Paul says. "These American fucks, they have an appetite for everything. They will just spend and spend and spend." Indeed, Paul has gotten rich, fabulously rich, by selling tens of millions of prescription painkillers to Americans over the internet for nearly a decade. But unlike Pepe's organization, Paul carefully avoids shipping street drugs like meth to the States. "It generates too much heat," he says. As the meeting winds down, Paul flashes a hint of his technical prowess, offering to send Pepe mobile phones that he has set up with encryption software to allow the two organizations to communicate secretly. He tells Pepe he can get him any weapons he needs out of Iran, particularly if a Liberian general can be produced to make the transaction look official. Then he pauses to reflect. "I can tell you, you won't find a better partner," he says. "He is a man," he explains, "who keeps his organization in line. One thing I tell all the guys, okay, everyone I deal with, just don't fucking steal. You know what I'm saying? That's the one thing that pisses me off. Earlier, he described an employee who stole $5 million from him, then began driving a Lamborghini around Manila, buying his girlfriend's designer handbags and diamond necklaces. The employee was no longer a problem, he said. He's moved on, let's put it that way. Now Paul has more management advice. Don't steal, he repeats, and don't fucking run your mouth to the government. You get caught doing anything, remember, you keep your mouth shut. You've got some guys, I'm sure you've had this. They come like this. He makes a motion as if operating a jabbering puppet. They get afraid in jail, and then they think that the government is going to help them. They think the government is their best friend. I'm sure you've seen this, right? That is only in movies, Pepe says. They are running their fucking mouth like this. What's going to happen when you get out? You make the deal. You think we're going to forget about you? He slaps his hands together. You have a problem, we help you. Your family has a problem, we help them. Nobody has a problem. Just follow these rules. We're very straight on that. So I tell you, we do business. You trust me 100%. We will deliver for you. 100%. This is a trust deal, Pepe says, before the three men stand up to shake hands. That's exactly what we're going to do. In the months before and after Paul and Pepe's meeting, a series of strange events occurred in disparate parts of the globe, events that appeared unrelated. I say appeared as if anyone on the outside was observing them at all. At the time, no one was, including me. Even if anyone had been, none of these incidents appeared tied to any other as they filtered into public view. Like a handful of random jigsaw puzzle pieces, each one was incomprehensible without an understanding of the larger picture. It would be a year before I picked up even one of those pieces to examine it, and several more before I began to understand the image that the whole collection of them combined to reveal. In March 2012, 6 months before Paul and Pepe's meeting in Liberia, agents from the United States Drug Enforcement Administration walked through the glass doors of a small pharmacy on Main Street in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. They were armed with search warrants targeting its 82-year-old owner, Charles Schultz. A pillar of the local community for four decades, Schultz had been charged with shipping more than 700,000 illegal painkiller prescriptions from the back of his two local pharmacies. In return, the agents calculated, he had received over $27 million in wire transfers from a mysterious Hong Kong bank account. Roughly a month later, officers from the Organized Crime and Triad Bureau in Hong Kong raided a warehouse in Sen Wan, a bayside district north of the city. Inside, they discovered 20 tons of ammonium nitrate fertilizer, divided into 1,000 bags, and falsely labeled as sodium chloride. It was enough to create an explosive 10 times more powerful than the one used in the Oklahoma City bombing. On the warehouse lease, they found the name of an Israeli-Australian citizen, a former member of an elite division of the Israeli Defense Forces. When they raided the man's office and apartment, they turned up deeds for two stash houses, receipts for tens of millions of dollars in gold bars, and handwritten directions to a meeting in Buenaventura, Colombia, with a man named Don Lucho, the head of one of the world's biggest cocaine cartels. Then, in November, a pair of spear fishermen diving off an atoll in Tonga discovered a wrecked 44-foot sailboat with a badly decomposed body on board. Lining the walls of the boat's cabin, local authorities found, were 204 bricks of cocaine, neatly wrapped in brown plastic and worth more than $90 million on the street in Australia, where they suspected it was destined. In early December, 3,000 miles to the northeast, a contractor for the National Security Agency named Edward Snowden organized a gathering of cryptography buffs in the back room of a strip mall storefront in Honolulu. After a couple dozen people had assembled, he plugged his laptop into a projector and began an instructional talk about a free program called TrueCrypt. It was, he said, the world's most secure software for encrypting a laptop hard drive, protecting it from the prying eyes of governments. Very little was known about the people behind TrueCrypt, he cautioned. The programmers who created it were anonymous. But Snowden also knew something about TrueCrypt that he was not ready to reveal. He had stolen documents from the NSA showing that the agency couldn't break it. When I began trying to investigate this series of events later, they were tantalizing but baffling to me. As I rewound back through them, each seemed like a kind of message from an adjacent reality that few of us experienced directly. In that world, I would learn, a brilliant self-made software programmer from South Africa could single-handedly build a dystopian company to rival today's tech giants. Through his creation, an online startup selling hundreds of millions of dollars worth of pills to American customers, he would become one of the largest individual contributors to America's burgeoning painkiller epidemic, and the most successful cybercriminal in history. He would leverage that fortune into a sprawling criminal empire, fulfilling his seemingly insatiable appetite for the clandestine and the illegal. His ambition for wealth and power would slip the bonds of the internet and enter the realm of flesh and blood. The scope of his criminal conduct, as one federal prosecutor later put it, is simply staggering. In the adjacent world he came to occupy, everything was for sale if you knew what to offer and to whom. Pure methamphetamine manufactured in North Korea. Yachts built to outrun any Coast Guard. Police protection in judges' favor. Crates of military-grade weapons. Private jets full of gold. Missile guidance systems, unbreakable encryption, African militias, explosives, kidnapping, torture, murder. Former soldiers from the United States, United Kingdom, and elsewhere, drifting in the murky realm of global security contracting, could reinvent themselves as roving assassins for hire. Call center managers in Tel Aviv could wake up and find themselves arms dealers. Family doctors could turn into conspirators in an international drug cartel at the click of a button. That world lurks just outside of our everyday perception, in the dark corners of the internet we never visit, the quiet ports where ships slip in by night, the back room of the clinic down the street. The events of 2012, I discovered, were simply the edges of that world crossing over into our own. And I came to understand how ordinary people could take one morally ambiguous step across that divide, then a second and a third, until suddenly cops or killers were at their door. There was one puzzle piece I couldn't get out of my head. At 6:30 a.m. on the morning of February 13th, 2012, Jeremy Jimena, a garbage collector in the Philippines, had just started his shift. He set out with his driver on their regular route through Taytay, an industrial city an hour east of Manila. It had rained most of the night, and a light drizzle fell as they turned down Paseo Monte Carlo, a quiet road with no lights. Their first stop was a large vacant lot overrun by low shrubs, a green carpet of vines, and a scattering of banana trees. The field wasn't an official pickup spot, but local residents often dumped garbage there, and the collectors had informally added it to their route. That morning there was a small pile of trash spilling into the road, two large bags filled with waste and a bulging, rolled-up bedspread. Jimena, a small, wiry man with jet-black hair and a wisp of a mustache, hopped off the truck and approached the pile. When he leaned down and grasped the damp edge of the blanket, he saw a woman's foot sticking out. Jimena dropped the blanket and ran, shouting to the driver, and the two of them abandoned the truck and sprinted to the municipal headquarters. There they told the local head of security what they'd found, and he called the police. Jimena returned to his route in a daze. He never spoke to the police himself, and never learned who the woman was. When I met him 4 years later, I didn't tell him what I knew, that her name was Catherine Lee, that she had been an accomplished real estate agent with a husband and child, that she'd been shot below each eye with a .22 caliber pistol, rolled up in a blanket, and dumped out of a van, that somehow, her death connected back to a pharmacist in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, a warehouse raid in Hong Kong, a wrecked boat in Tonga. Jimena didn't seem to want to know those details anyway. Mostly, he just seemed to want to forget. For years, he told me, he dreamed of her every night. The woman, wrapped in a blanket, sometimes she would be asking him for help, other times she would just scream. So much of reporting, it took me a long time to discover, is waiting. Waiting for people to call back. Waiting for documents to arrive in the mail. Waiting for a plane to take you halfway across the world, only to arrive at the appointed time in a dreary office and sit in a plastic chair, waiting for an official who never shows up. Standing on a doorstep, waiting to see if a victim's family will return. Sending out pleas for information and staring at a phone, waiting for them to boomerang back. All of it, in some sense, amounts to waiting for the same thing, that one sliver of fact that will help make sense of all the ones that came before it. In December 2015, when I flew to the Philippines to try to untangle the connections behind Catherine Lee's still unsolved murder, I discovered entirely new magnitudes of waiting. Much of it I did in a rented van, with a Filipina-American journalist I'd enlisted to assist me, Aurora Almendral. The two of us were stuck in the grip of Manila's endless traffic, crawling to appointments that would inevitably involve more waiting once we arrived. So it was that one afternoon, a few weeks before Christmas, we pulled up to a neglected cinderblock building on a steep hill in the town of Taytay. We'd been told that this was the investigative division of the local police. We walked in, past a woman stapling paper holiday decorations to the wall, through a pair of swinging doors, and into a cramped room with four desks. An air conditioner rattled in the window, and three detectives pecked away on ancient-looking computers. We tried to rouse one of them and explain the reason we were there, to visit the vacant lot where Jeremy Jimena had encountered Catherine Lee's body. The chief of police had promised, over the phone, to take us there, but that morning he'd been called away by kidnapping. The other cops had no idea when he would return. No one claimed to know much about the body, and in the years since the murder, those people who did know something had tended to disappear. Some murders, perhaps, were better left unsolved. So Almendral and I settled in to wait, sitting on a bench in front of a framed police loyalty pledge that hung on the wall. "Remember that an ounce of loyalty is worth a pound of cleverness," it read in English. "If you must growl, condemn, and internally find fault, why? Resign your position. And when you're outside, damn to your heart's content. But as long as you're part of the institution, do not condemn it. If you do, the first high wind that comes along will blow you away, and probably you'll never know why." It read to me more like the blood oath of a criminal enterprise than the pledge of a law enforcement organization. But this was before I fully grasped how easily, in the right conditions, the two could sometimes come to resemble one another. After some coaxing by Almendral in Tagalog, an officer named Abigail Del Monte agreed to pull the case file for us. She returned from a back room and proceeded to flip through it idly at her desk, as if trying to discern why I had flown 8,000 miles and then driven 3 hours to visit a crime scene nearly 4 years after the fact. Finally, another detective showed up, a friendly guy in a jean jacket. He introduced himself as George Arata. Suddenly, everyone shifted into action. "You're here for the Catherine Lee case," he said. "Okay, let's go." We offered our slightly beat-up van and driver for transportation, and Del Monte decided to join as well. Along the way, we picked up the local watchman who had called the cops after Jimena's discovery. Then we drove over to the vacant lot. At the site, the watchman showed us where the body had been positioned and how he'd marked off the area back in February 2012. "The body was moved a little bit by the guy who picked up the blanket," he said. "I didn't find out anything about who she was." We walked over to an older woman selling drinks at a roadside stand. She remembered that day. "I saw the body," she said, "but it was covered up, so we couldn't see who it was. Three streets down, somebody had been missing for a couple of days, so we thought it could be them." Later, word came back from the cops that the body belonged to a real estate agent from another part of the country. When I asked what happened to the missing neighbor, the drink stand woman said that the family had just moved on. I wandered around taking photos, looking for signs that Jimena's horrible discovery had somehow transformed this otherwise ordinary place. If the body had left a mark, it was invisible. We piled back into the van, and on the drive to the station, I asked the detectives whether they often encountered corpses in Taytay, a city of just over 300,000 people. "Sometimes over 5 in a month, but not over 10," Arata said cheerfully. "It's kind of a well-known place to dump bodies. Don't tell the chief." He laughed. "The cases were difficult to solve," he said. "The bodies were often mutilated or broken up and stuffed in garbage bags." I asked if I could look at the case file, and to my surprise, Del Monte turned and handed it to me. Photos taken at the crime scene showed Lee's body, unwrapped, dressed in a black jacket and jeans, lying face down with her feet in the road. A crowd stood at the edge of a police cordon. The facts in the file were spare. A team from the National Police's Scene of Crime Operations Division had arrived at 7:50 that morning. An autopsy report listed the cause of instantaneous death, a gunshot wound under each eye. The investigators had little trouble identifying the victim. She was found with her identification. Catherine Christina Lee, 43, from Las Piñas City, an hour south of Taytay. Also with the body were a cell phone, an Anne Klein wristwatch, a silver bracelet, and a pair of rings, one silver and one gold. She had not been robbed. There was no sign of sexual assault. Flipping through the file as we drove back to the police station, I came across mention of a 2015 meeting between Filipino officers and a special agent from the DEA's Los Angeles office, along with a copy of his business card. I wasn't the first person, it seemed, to travel to the Philippines and ask questions about the body. Hoping to make some sense of what happened in Taytay, Almendral and I went to see Rizaldi Rivera, an agent at the Philippine National Bureau of Investigation who we learned had been assigned to the Lee murder case. The NBI's Death Investigation Division was housed in a charmless room with tiled floors and the insipid fluorescent lighting that marks bureaucracies worldwide. On the wall was a whiteboard outlining agents' assignments, organized by nickname: Cardinal, Undertaker, Mechanic, Hitman, Braveheart, Snake Doc, KGB. A genial cop with a waist-length ponytail and a talent for sharpshooting, Rivera was a natural showman. Almost immediately after we'd shaken hands, he urged me to check out his target shooting videos on YouTube. Later I did, and had to admit that the clips were impressive. In one, he cuts a credit card in half at 20 yards with a handgun, aiming over his shoulder using a compact mirror. Most people called him Zaldi, but his nickname around the MBI offices was Slayer, bestowed after three shootouts early in his career, one of which left a bullet in his thigh. Rivera had picked up the Catherine Lee case after her husband contacted the MBI and requested that it look into her murder, the day after the body was discovered. The agency is required by law to take over cases at the request of victims' families, and often those requests stem from concerns that local officers are incompetent, or worse. The ranks of local and national police in the Philippines are rife with corruption, and the MBI had a better, though not spotless, reputation for integrity. In the case of a murder for hire, which is what Rivera deduced the Lee case to be, it wasn't unusual to hear whispers that cops themselves were in on the job. Police work pays poorly, with as much as 60% of the national police force living below the poverty line. Contract murder was a thriving industry in the Philippines. Having someone killed cost as little as 5,000 pesos, or around $100. I cannot provide the real names of the witnesses or the addresses and photos in order to protect them, Rivera said when we arrived. Otherwise, I can probably answer any question you want me to answer. He gestured to a pair of plastic lawn chairs in a cubicle, facing a desk completely devoid of papers or equipment. We started at the beginning, talking above the sounds of an NBA game, basketball being a Philippine national obsession, from a television somewhere just out of sight. Over the course of an hour, Rivera laid out everything he knew about Lee's murder. He spoke in the world-weary manner of a cop who had seen his share of vicious crimes. But at times, he sounded as mystified as I was about how all the pieces of Lee's killing fit together. Rivera had reconstructed Lee's movements from interviews with everyone she had encountered the day she disappeared, as well as clues found on her laptop and phone. The day before her body was discovered, Lee had been out showing properties to two foreigners, Canadians named Bill Maxwell and Tony. For some of the showings, she had invited along several friends and fellow real estate agents. They'd last seen her climb into a silver Toyota Innova minivan with the Canadians, mid-afternoon, to go look at another property. From the friends and a security guard at one gated community, Rivera gleaned enough detail to generate sketches. Two white men, one goateed and the other clean-shaven, both wearing baseball caps. But when it came to their identities, he hit a wall. It was very hard to check with the Immigration Bureau in the Philippines, Rivera said, because Bill Maxwell and Tony, the names were fictitious. As for physical evidence, there was little to go on. The body had been out in the rain long enough that Philippine police technicians were unable to check for trace elements of DNA. The Toyota van lacked license plates, although the security guard had written down the number from a temporary registration sticker. When Rivera tried to trace it, nothing matched. He concluded that the number was probably faked. Without the van, there would be no fingerprints, no hair, no fibers. One aspect of the crime stood out to Rivera. Lee had been shot under each eye, with what forensics determined was a .22 caliber handgun. In our experience, he said, if you shoot a person dead, you don't normally use a low caliber firearm. Hitmen in the Philippines, he said, typically used Armalite weapons, hand grenades, or a .40 caliber pistol. This is one of the few times that I discovered that the caliber was a .22 Magnum. To Rivera, the weapon said something about the crime, namely that it might be a type of signature killing. He believed that Lee's death was not a crime of passion, but a professional murder committed by someone looking to send a message. That's an arrogant way of killing, putting two bullet holes beneath the eye, he said. That's not how you normally execute a person. After a few months, Rivera's leads dried up. Other murders required his attention. But like Jimena, he was haunted by Lee's murder and his failure to solve it. I couldn't sleep soundly at night, he said. I was thinking about that case, but the fact is, I cannot just proceed without solid evidence. For 3 years, the Lee file languished at the NBI. Then in April 2015, Rivera got a call from the U.S. Embassy in Manila. The Americans had some information regarding the Lee murder. A man the DEA had arrested 3.5 years earlier on drug charges had been cooperating with the government, and he had tipped them off to possible suspects. A few months after that phone call, three DEA agents came to meet with Agent Rivera at the Death Investigations Division. Rivera walked them through what he'd learned about the case, using a PowerPoint presentation to recap the investigation's key points. When he finished, he asked them jokingly, "From 1 to 10, how would you rate my investigation?" Everyone laughed. The DEA agents confirmed Rivera's hunch. Bill Maxwell and Tony weren't the men's real names. They were not Canadian, nor did they live in the Philippines. They were, the agents suspected, Americans from Roxboro, North Carolina. Rivera introduced the DEA agents to the witnesses he had interviewed about Lee's last days. The agents showed them photos of the two Americans, Rivera told me, mingled with 7 or 8 different photos of 7 or 8 different individuals. Some of the witnesses identified the two Americans as having met with Lee. Others didn't. But after those sessions, one of the DEA agents faxed a report back to the States. The next day, the two men were arrested in Roxboro. Rivera was pleased with the arrests, but he also expressed frustration about his own continuing investigation, which he resumed after the DEA meeting. A local accomplice had allegedly helped supply the murder weapon and vehicle to the suspects, but Rivera still didn't have enough information to track him down. He pointed out to me that the MBI hadn't gotten any credit for the arrests, while at the same time suggesting that such credit was unnecessary. "We were not included. We were happy about that. It's no problem with us. We have nothing to gain with being famous." But something else was bothering him. There was someone, or something, much bigger behind the crime that remained shrouded in mystery. Why would the U.S. government send agents across the world to gather evidence against two Americans for the murder of a Filipino woman? Overseas murders, no matter how tragic, typically don't fall under American jurisdiction. Why not just extradite the pair to the Philippines, where the crime occurred, and hand them off to the MBI? I had the same questions. Perhaps it was related to something more fundamental about the case that I still didn't understand. Why was Catherine Lee important enough for two men from North Carolina to fly across the world to kill her? Rivera had an answer, although at first he was reluctant to tell me. The crime, he said, was the work of the mastermind. At first, Rivera would only identify this mastermind as the head of a powerful crime organization based in Manila. But he did tell me the motive behind the murder. The mastermind had once enlisted Catherine Lee to purchase vacation property for him in Batangas, a coastal region south of Manila. He had given her money, at least 50 million pesos, or around $1 million. But the deal never materialized, Rivera said, because the person who Catherine Lee instructed to do the verification of the land, to arrange the deeds and everything, went off with the money. That person had also been killed, Rivera said. The body was never found. And then the mastermind had ordered Lee's murder, too. Catherine Lee, it seemed, had stepped across the invisible divide between her world and the underworld, oblivious to the chain of events she had set in motion that would end in her own death. I asked Rivera if he would tell me the name of the mastermind, and at first he refused. He had a name, but he didn't want to say it. The DEA, he told me, would neither confirm nor deny. But I already knew who it had to be. "If I tell you the name that I think it is, will you tell me if that's the person?" I asked. "I will confirm," he said. "Paul LaRue." Rivera slammed his fist down on the table, then held my gaze for several seconds in silence. He lowered his voice to a whisper. "This Paul LaRue," he said, "is a very badass guy." Part 1. Openings. Chapter 1. The Investigators. 2007 to 2008. Two rookie investigators start pulling on strings. The vastness of RX Limited emerges. Going undercover online. Kent Bailey gets drafted. A phone call to Somalia. The whole thing started with a spreadsheet. DEA investigator Kimberly Brill was sitting in her government-issue cubicle in downtown Minneapolis one afternoon in October 2007 when a package arrived from FedEx. Not just via FedEx, but from the FedEx Corporation itself. On a hunch, Brill and another investigator, Stephen Holdren, had sent a subpoena to the shipping company weeks before, asking for all records on an account used by a pharmacy called Altgeld Garden Drug on the south side of Chicago. Brill and Holdren were what the DEA calls diversion investigators, who focus on the ways prescription drugs are diverted into illegal markets. Unlike DEA agents, diversion investigators don't carry guns and have no power to arrest anyone. The glamour busts of cartel bosses and meth distribution rings were typically as distant from Brill and Holdren's work as a murder case is from a traffic cop's. Most of their time was spent taking down shady doctors and pharmacy pill mills for overprescribing and overdispensing addictive or dangerous medications. Altgeld appeared to be just such a target. Brill and Holdren had come across it by searching the internet for websites selling a drug called phentermine, a type of amphetamine. Phentermine is a controlled substance under U.S. law, illegal to sell without a prescription, and heavily regulated because of its potential for abuse, making it a classic candidate for diversion. Brill and Holdren had little problem finding online sellers willing to ship it without a prescription. So they bought some using undercover names and credit cards in what the DEA calls a controlled buy. When the drugs arrived via FedEx, they had the evidence they needed to go after the pharmacy for illegal distribution. All of this was routine, the kind of low-level buy-and-bust operation that diversion investigators carry out all the time. But Brill and Holdren decided to look one layer deeper. They sent out the subpoena to FedEx requesting data on the shipping account used by Altgeld. Looking back later, it would seem almost preposterous that such a small decision could lead them into a maze of complexity and criminality, one that connected a small pharmacy in Chicago to a murdered real estate agent in the Philippines. But every chess match has to start with an opening move. Holdren wasn't at his cubicle when the FedEx package arrived. He had just stepped out for a walk. So Brill opened it at her desk, extracted a small thumb drive, and popped it into her computer. She opened up the spreadsheet file on it and began scrolling through. Then she picked up the phone and called Holdren on his cell. "Oh my God, Steve," she said. "You've got to see this." Brill and Holdren were, by most measures, still rookies at the DEA, not necessarily the investigators first on the list for big cases. They had met 3 years before at the DEA Training Academy in Quantico, Virginia, and both were assigned to the Minnesota office by chance. Brill, a native Minnesotan, had joined the DEA at the age of 33. She graduated from the University of North Dakota Law School and worked for half a decade as an attorney before deciding to join the government. She was the portrait of a hardworking Midwesterner, friendly and understated, but relentlessly disciplined. "I was a first child, a rule follower," she said. She was attracted to the DEA by the idea of catching doctors and pharmacists who had betrayed their oaths. Holdren had spent his whole career in law enforcement, also entering the DEA at 33, after stints as a Border Patrol agent and an investigator in the U.S. Office of Personnel Management, where he conducted national security background checks. Both investigators were familiar with the basics of tracking web pharmacies, having undergone an online investigation course as part of their 13-week training at Quantico. Called Basic Telecommunications Exploitation, it covered how to use the internet to build a case using controlled buys. Long before the national opioid epidemic began making headlines, the DEA had become concerned with the proliferation of prescription drug sales online and the potential for web pharmacies to funnel dangerous medication onto American streets. But in their first few years at the DEA, Brill and Holdren both found themselves attacking what they felt was the outer edge of the problem. They would bust one online pharmacy, only to find that another had sprung up in its place. Like a pair of city cops who only picked up corner dealers, they weren't making a dent in the criminal organization supplying the drugs to the street. Brill and Holdren had been talking for a while about finding a case to work together, 50-50, something that would go beyond local pharmacy raids. "We were trying to get to the head of the beast," as Brill put it. "Somebody had to be paying, and somebody had to be profiting greatly, and they needed help running such a large operation. I don't think we knew. It could be anybody." Now, buried in the lines of the spreadsheet on Brill's screen were the outlines of a case unlike any that they had ever seen. There were hundreds of thousands of entries, and they weren't just shipments from one mom-and-pop pharmacy in Chicago. Instead, a single national shipping account, number 22328, was being used by more than 40 other drug stores. Collectively, these pharmacies were shipping thousands of drug orders a week. "You could see that there were these pharmacies all over the country, shipping to customers all over the country," Brill said. The account had been registered and paid for by a company called RX Limited. There were several emails and two phone numbers attached to the account, along with Florida and Texas addresses that both turned out to be mail drops, a kind of virtual mailbox bought over the internet. RX Limited itself was registered as a corporation in Delaware. The organization clearly was trying to act like a legitimate American business, but from what Brill and Holdren could tell, it wasn't any type of pharmaceutical company or wholesale distributor. Other than the mail drops, it seemed to have no real American presence at all. Whatever RX Limited was, it was engaged in the distribution of a staggering amount of pharmaceuticals. Additional subpoenas produced still more spreadsheets, showing that account number 22328 and others connected to it had been used by more than 100 pharmacies since late 2006. They were located in different parts of the United States, Brill later testified, They were smaller, independent pharmacies, so not things like CVS or Walgreens. The investigators discovered that in 1 3-week period in 2007, these pharmacies had collectively shipped more than 57,000 drug orders. The math was mind-boggling. Rx Limited was, at a minimum, responsible for shipping millions of orders of prescription drugs a year through FedEx. The spreadsheet showed that the customers receiving the pills, like the pharmacies sending them, were scattered around the country. Those customers' orders rarely originated at their local pharmacies. An order placed online in Illinois was just as likely to be shipped from an Rx Limited connected pharmacy in Tennessee as from one down the street. To understand how all this was possible, Brill and Holdren needed to get inside the pharmacies themselves. Over the next few months, working from opposite ends of the diversion group's small cluster of cubicles in the DEA's concrete tower in Minneapolis, they pulled the names of 3 Rx Limited drugstores off the FedEx account, one each in Minnesota, Texas, and Illinois. With the help of the state's pharmacy boards, they then conducted what looked like routine inspections. On one of the visits, to La Jolla Drugs in Chicago, they hit the jackpot. A pharmacy technician happily walked the investigators through the steps they took to fill Rx Limited's online orders. Rx Limited had provided La Jolla Drugs with a free computer, printer, and FedEx supplies, together with a step-by-step manual. The technician would log on to a website, download a document containing drug orders, then open a custom program called PCMS. Inside PCMS, which seemed to be software created by Rx Limited solely for this purpose, the technician could check off each order as it was filled, then generate the FedEx label and send out the drugs. That explained how all these small pharmacies were able to ship such a huge volume. Rx Limited was supplying both the orders and the technology to fill them. But where were the orders coming from in the first place? Holdren typed the name Rx Limited, together with a Texas mail drop address, into a search engine and turned up a site called acmemeds.com. The site looked like a legitimate online drugstore. Calling itself a trusted online pharmacy since 2004, it featured a stock photograph of a doctor and a note offering U.S. licensed pharmacies, U.S. licensed physicians, FedEx overnight shipping. Visitors to the site could search among dozens of drugs and place an order using a credit card. If they ran into any trouble, they could call a 24/7 toll-free customer service line or access a live help chat. By searching the web using blocks of text and phone numbers they found on acmemeds.com, Holdren and Brill would eventually discover hundreds of similar websites, with names like cheaprxmeds.net, allfarmmeds.com, buymedscheap.com, yourpills.com, speedyrxdrugs.com, allthebestrx.com, ibuymedscheap.com, myonlinedrugstore.com, preapprovedrx.com, matrixmeds.com, and 123onlinepharmacy.com. Not all of the sites were necessarily owned by Rx Limited directly. Many of them appeared to be what are called affiliates, a kind of marketing front that independent contractors on the internet could set up and use to attract drug-buying customers, who were then funneled into the Rx Limited network. To attract affiliates, Rx Limited offered a pre-made website and the promise of a 60% commission on every sale. Those commissions were coordinated through sites like rxpayouts.com, netbizbucks.com, and pillengine.com. "Open your own online pharmacy," the banner atop rxpayouts.com proclaimed. "The rxpayouts.com affiliate program is the premier pharmacy opportunity on the internet." The affiliate's marketing strategy seemed largely to involve sending spam email to massive mailing lists and gaming search engines so that a site like yourpills.com would appear atop the results when someone searched for a particular drug name on Google. The websites appeared to offer a wide range of drugs, everything from Propecia, the anti-baldness pill, to generic forms of Viagra. But when Brill and Holdren started digging into the pharmacy's records, they discovered that the vast bulk of Rx Limited's business derived from 3 specific drugs. The first, Ultram, was the brand name for a synthetic opioid called Tramadol, which, like the better-known opioids OxyContin and fentanyl, was developing a reputation for abuse, although largely outside of the United States. Soma, generic name Carisoprodol, was a muscle relaxant often prescribed for back problems. And the third, Fioricet, was also often prescribed to treat tension headaches and migraines. In addition to being powerful painkillers, the 3 drugs shared another property Brill and Holdren realized was crucial to Rx Limited's scope. None were considered controlled substances by the U.S. government. Dictated by an ever-evolving law known as the Controlled Substances Act, drugs that the government views as dangerous are classified according to 5 schedules, ranked roughly from most dangerous to least using Roman numerals 1 through 5. Schedule 1 includes drugs that the U.S. government has deemed lack any medical application and have a high potential for abuse, including heroin and LSD. Schedule 2 drugs, such as OxyContin and fentanyl, by contrast, have medical applications, but retain a high potential for abuse and harm. Schedule 3 drugs are considered slightly less dangerous, and so on. The Rx Limited network of websites did not appear to traffic in scheduled drugs. Indeed, the websites themselves demonstrated a sharp awareness of the lines around U.S. drug law, with prominent disclaimers stating that they did not offer controlled substances. But evidence was growing that Ultram, Soma, and Furoset weren't, as commonly portrayed, safe alternatives to OxyContin. As far as Brill and Holdren were concerned, the drugs were habit-forming, at a minimum. Rx Limited's focus on these three painkillers, the investigators concluded, was a deliberate effort to avoid legal scrutiny. If Rx Limited was potentially skirting the law in one way, Brill and Holdren suspected it might be breaking it in others. For starters, Furoset contained an ingredient that was controlled, a Schedule 3 drug called butalbital. In Furoset, it was mixed with caffeine and acetaminophen, the medication in Tylenol. Whether the combination met the criteria for controlled substance wasn't entirely clear, but it hardly mattered. As a technical, legal matter, even non-controlled drugs required a valid prescription to distribute. Rx Limited sites like Acme Meds seem to acknowledge this reality as well, with prominent disclaimers. Our company is committed to meeting and exceeding all government regulations covering this new form of healthcare provision. AcmeMeds.com will only refer your order to certified physicians that are fully licensed. Even if that were true, though the investigators strongly doubted it was, the volume of prescriptions flowing through the FedEx account didn't make sense. Over the previous 16 months, Brill and Holdren estimated, Rx Limited had delivered 72 million doses of painkillers to Americans. Something about Rx Limited smelled illegal and dangerous. They just weren't exactly sure what it was yet. The best way to figure it out, they decided, was to start making undercover buys. Brill concocted an identity, Sarah Johnson, arranged for a fake Minnesota ID, and bought prepaid credit cards at the nearby Mall of America. Then, on AcmeMeds.com and other sites, she signed up as a customer. For an address, she used a mail drop at a FedEx store near the office. Her first order was for 30 tablets of Soma, the muscle relaxant. On the order page, she was taken to a medical questionnaire that the site claimed would be reviewed by a doctor. There she was asked to answer yes or no to questions like, "Is your personal healthcare practitioner aware that you are requesting this medication?" and "Have you had a physical exam in the last 12 months?" The questionnaire had a blank space for symptoms. Brill typed in back spasms and submitted her order. A customer service representative from the site followed up with an email reporting that the order had been queued for review. Over the next year, Brill and Holdren made dozens of such orders, following the same process each time. The symptoms that Sarah Johnson offered ranged from back pain to neck to a made-up condition they called Stratusky. She never heard from a doctor. Each time, her order was eventually approved and shipped out, complete with a tracking number and confirmation email. When the delivery arrived, it came labeled with the name of the doctor who had written the prescription and the pharmacy that had filled it. When Brill and Holdren had the drugs tested at DEA labs, the results were always the same. Rx Limited had supplied exactly what Sarah Johnson had ordered. The investigators were getting a full picture of how Rx Limited operated. The network's websites took online orders from customers in the United States, who found the sites through spam emails and ordinary online searches for painkillers. Those orders were then funneled, virtually, to real American doctors who wrote real prescriptions without ever meeting their patients. Those prescriptions were then sent electronically to real independent pharmacies, to be filled and shipped using Rx Limited supplied technology. The doctors and pharmacies themselves were disposable to the organization, Brill realized. Take one out, and another one could simply be slotted into place. The network kept humming on. The scheme was so multi-layered that none of the deliveries Brill and Holdren had received made any reference to Rx Limited. The pharmacies don't know the other pharmacies, the doctors don't know the other doctors, Brill said. None of them ultimately know who they're working for. Neither, at this point, did Brill or Holdren. There was, however, one unusual name that surfaced several times in the data. It was the thinnest of reeds at first, one they had spotted in the hundreds of thousands of lines in the FedEx spreadsheets. Amid the shipments of pills fanning out across the United States, they found one international order, a package delivered to a hotel in Manila in 2005 to someone named Paul LaRue. Kent Bailey was at a bar in Minneapolis when he first heard the name that would come to dominate his life. It was the spring of 2008, and Bailey, a veteran special agent with the DEA, the gun-toting kind, had recently transferred from the Twin Cities to Chantilly, Virginia, to join the agency's Special Operations Division. Located at its own headquarters 25 miles east of D.C., SOD was formed in 1994 to coordinate complicated investigations involving multiple agencies and jurisdictions, cases that span domestic and international drug trafficking. After a decade and a half chasing dealers on the street, Bailey had been promoted to SOD as a supervising agent in the Pharmaceutical, Chemical, and Internet Division. A weekend visit back to Minnesota coincided with a going-away party for one of the agents on his former team at a downtown sports bar called Maddie B's. At one point during the festivities, a pair of diversion investigators Bailey knew from the office buttonholed him. "Hey, I want to ask you something," Kimberly Brill said. She and the other investigator, Stephen Holdren, had been poking around on a case for several months, something they thought could be big. Between beers, Brill and Holdren outlined the basics of what they'd found on RX Limited, trying to impress upon Bailey that it all amounted to something more than just a typical pill mill. Altgeld and the other pharmacies weren't online businesses. They were merely the frontline fulfillment of a much larger network. "This is national scale," Brill told Bailey. "We think it's illegal. Is there anything you can do to help?" Bailey, after feigning outrage that they hadn't called him sooner, said he'd take a look. "Send me the email addresses and whatever telephone numbers you have. I'll start running them in our database to see what's happening." LaRue's name had surfaced several more times in the investigation, after Brill and Holdren had initially seen it on the FedEx package delivered in Manila. For one, they determined that RX Limited was renting server space at a company called Q9 in Canada, with an account tied to the email plarue@swprofessionals.com. The email led them to a defunct website for a programming business called Software Professionals, registered in Mauritius but located in South Africa, and owned by one Paul LaRue. The name had started to rise up their list of important figures in RX Limited. They also noticed that several of the servers at Q9 were named after chess pieces, they told Bailey. It almost felt like an invitation to join the game. They'd christened the case Operation Checkmate. A few days after his 2008 encounter with Brill and Holdren, Bailey was back at his desk in Virginia. The East Coast posting wasn't much of a natural habitat for the 46-year-old agent. He'd grown up in a tiny town in Minnesota called Thief River Falls, just across the border from Winnipeg. Options out of high school were limited, so he enlisted in the Army at age 17 to become an airborne radio operator. Believing he was training to manage communications equipment on planes, he quickly discovered that instead he would be carrying a radio and jumping out of them. "My recruiter lied to me," he said. "If I'd known what I was going to end up doing, I would have said no freaking way." He took to it, though, and eventually he joined the Army's Special Forces 2nd Ranger Battalion in Fort Lewis, Washington. By the early 1990s, back injuries from jumping kept him out of the first Gulf War and threatened to confine him to a desk job. One day he was assigned to train a group of visiting DEA agents preparing for operations in South America, survival, escape, and evasion, booby traps. After a few weeks of hanging out with them, he decided to quit the military and join the agency. After his training, Bailey landed in L.A., where the agency was targeting drug trafficking organizations south of the border. Bailey employed his friendly Midwestern accent to mask a no-bullshit approach to law enforcement and paid his dues with grueling street work. In an 18-month investigation tagged Operation Silent Thunder, he helped crack a methamphetamine ring in which Hell's Angels had linked up with Mexican traffickers and white supremacists, resulting in almost 300 arrests. Over the years, Bailey developed a philosophy about the kingpins on the other side of the law. Even the most successful ones, he concluded, generally weren't the evil geniuses that they appeared from the street. Their every maneuver might look perfectly calculated, but when the agents finally had them in custody, they would usually discover that those brilliant evasions were, more often than not, just dumb luck. After 4 years in Los Angeles, Bailey's wife pressed him to look for a post closer to their extended family. He found one as a field supervisor in Minneapolis, running a team that did everything from street busts to multi-state investigations. In September 2007, when he was offered the promotion to SOD, he viewed it as a step up in title, but not necessarily in duties. The Internet Division was staffed by diversion investigators and dealt largely with offshore pharmacies in India and China. He'd worked the southwest border and thought he should be chasing Mexican cartels, where the action was. "I have to have agents help me get on the Internet, and I've taken Vicodin once in my life," he thought. "What the fuck do I know about this?" but Bailey prided himself on outworking any problem. In Virginia, he chose a small desk under an air vent and set up a telephone and three computer screens, one for internal work only, one for classified documents, and one connected to the outside internet. He viewed the job as a temporary way station. His wife and two kids had stayed back in Minnesota. He'd try to make the best of it. Now, sitting in front of his monitors in the spring of 2008, he considered Brill and Holdren's pleadings at the bar. He examined the list of email addresses and phone numbers they had managed to gather off the FedEx account and their controlled buys. From the outset, he could see that whatever RX Limited was, it was international, its communications tracing arcs across the globe. The Special Operations Division existed precisely for this kind of case. Bailey started with a phone number that particularly interested the investigators, a Philippine mobile they'd found registered to Paul LaRue, the man who had received the package in Manila. Bailey passed the number to an analyst at SOD and got a report back listing its last 30 days' worth of calls. "I see numbers to Ghana," he said. "I see numbers to the Congo. I see numbers to the Philippines, obviously. I see numbers in Brazil." Then Bailey saw a series of calls that stopped him cold. They were back and forth to Somalia. Suddenly he began to suspect that he was dealing with something larger than just RX Limited. "He'd never been to Somalia, but those are my brothers that went down in Black Hawk Down. That's the battalion I served in for 12 years," he said. "People go to those places because they are lawless." He still knew almost nothing about LaRue, but looking at those calls, he was certain of one thing. This guy is not setting up a fucking pharmacy in Somalia. Chapter 2. The Pharmacist, the Doctor. 2006 to 2008. Charles Schultz grabs a lifeline. Prabhakar Tempati sees the promise of RX Limited. In the summer of 2006, Charles Schultz was struggling to figure out how to stay afloat. A 74-year-old pharmacist in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, he had been in the drugstore business for his entire adult life. He had opened his first local pharmacy more than 40 years earlier, in the early 1960s. Together with his wife, Jean, he had built Schultz Pharmacy into an established business, set on a quaint street in downtown Oshkosh, a city hugging the western shore of Lake Winnebago. In the 1980s, he bought a second store, Medicine Mart, 130 miles south in the town of Monroe. For decades, Schultz, who even into his 70s carried himself with an impeccable posture reminiscent of his college ROTC days, was known in the community as a generous boss and a devoted family man who cluttered up his house with books. Over the last few years, however, a plague of misfortune seemed to have set upon him. His business was in steep decline as big box drugstore chains crowded out independent pharmacies, like Schultz and Medicine Mart. A business that had once afforded him enough income to buy a vacation home was now selling items below cost just to keep customers coming in. His family, meanwhile, was beset by health problems. A son suffered from a severe psychiatric disorder that required nearly full-time care, and Schultz himself had been struck by a series of small heart attacks, brought on in part by the stress of running a struggling business and the long hours spent shuttling between Oshkosh and Monroe, well past retirement age. Then, in the summer of 2006, salvation appeared out of the blue. Schultz received an unsolicited letter, by fax, from a company he'd never heard of called Alphanet Trading, with an address in Costa Mesa, California. The letter offered him an enticing opportunity. Alphanet could augment Schultz's in-store sales with online prescriptions, without any investment from him. His role couldn't have been simpler. If he signed on as an Alphanet pharmacy, the company would supply him with fully outfitted computers and as many online orders as he could handle. All he would have to do was log into the company's system, fill valid prescriptions written by American doctors, and ship them using Alphanet's FedEx account. He'd then be reimbursed by bank transfer for the wholesale cost of the prescription, plus $3.50 for each one filled. At first, Schultz ignored the offer, which sounded suspiciously like a get-rich scam. But when his cash flow tightened the next month, he reconsidered and conducted some online research to determine if it was real. Alphanet's website looked legitimate enough. Next to a photo of five friendly-looking business people was a pitch similar to the one in his letter. "Alphanet Trading is your mail-order pharmacy partner. We contract with pharmacies in several states to handle order fulfillment for us. Our mail-order program is, in essence, a prescription refill program, in which customers are required to have already received the initial prescription they are seeking beforehand. They must have their primary healthcare provider aware that they are taking this medication. they are required to have had a complete physical exam by their physician every 6 months. Schultz was intrigued enough to call the company's recruiter, listed on the fax. He was interested, he told the man, but still harbored doubts about the ethics of the operation. The recruiter quickly dispelled them. Online pharmacies were a booming business, he said, and a cheaper option for patients than constantly returning to doctors for new prescriptions to treat chronic conditions. Alphanet was offering the chance for smaller pharmacies to get a piece of a new market and help people in the process. The recruiter sent Schultz copies of licenses belonging to the physicians who wrote prescriptions for its network to prove they were legitimate. He also emphasized that Alphanet didn't sell controlled substances, instead specializing in non-controlled painkillers like Ultram, Soma, and Fioricet. If an online pharmacy is asking you to ship controlled drugs, you better put your fees away for a lawyer, he added, because what you're doing is illegal. To further put Schultz's mind at ease, Alphanet's representative gave him the number of a former DEA agent in Florida. Schultz called him up, and the man confirmed that Alphanet's business was above the law. Schultz felt reassured enough to sign up for the network. The computers arrived by FedEx with instructions on how to set them up. Before long, his pharmacies were filling as many online orders as in-person ones. He hired a new full-time pharmacy technician at each location just to handle them. I would come in the morning. There was a program that I would get into that would have the orders, one technician later said. I would print the order, the purchase invoice, the shipping statement, the FedEx label. She would then hand the labels off to the pharmacist to fill the order and place the bottle in a FedEx envelope.